Today I'm doing, I'm substituting for my good friend and colleague, Dr. Rick Oliver. I am going to enter into presenting some of the material that he took the lead in presenting. We team taught this summer, but I would be the lead in certain areas, he was the lead in other areas. Today I am doing his whole seminar. Now, I want you to know that I am not a geologist, I am not a herpetologist, and I'm not a zoologist. So today I'm going to be presenting material that we've thought through and talked about, but I'm sure that you can stump me if you want to get very technical. Now with Rick, they would fire the questions and he would just give you answers back. So today, if I have to tell you I don't know, you just know that I'm doing my best to impersonate Rick Oliver and present material that he put together and which we have been presenting together through these summer months. So that's kind of a caveat if I can't help you. The other thing is that on this particular worksheet are not listed about the 20-some resources that were used in putting the two seminars together dealing with science. Again, on Monday, if you would be interested in those resources, they actually came at the end of the first worksheet, which was a worksheet on Does the Design Demand a Designer? And I'm sure we can run some copies of those for you and get you some copies of the books and some of the journals that were used in compiling the things that you're going to see this morning. Okay? How about, is that enough of a caveat? Have I engendered a little grace from you guys, because I'm going to need it? This is not, no grace. Jerry says no grace. Thanks, Jerry. Now I'm going to pray and I'm going to get grace from the only source to really get grace, and then we'll get started. Let's pray. Lord, I so thank you for the privilege of being here and the privilege of apprehending all that you have done and apprehending the truth about not only our redemption, but the truth about creation, the truth about the world as we see it. I pray that, again, that as we move through this material, that you will shape and correct and equip in just the ways that you desire. Pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. You have a worksheet today. Rick does worksheets different than Roger, so you don't have blanks. Rick doesn't like blanks in worksheets, all right? So there's no blanks in these worksheets. So those of you who have pencils or pens out, you can sheath them. You're okay this morning. What we're going to do, what I'm going to do, is address the question, does science disprove a creator? As we look at the latest kind of scientific findings, the data that's being produced in the various branches of scientific endeavor, what's coming out? Is it lending more credence to a mechanistic, naturalistic, uniformitarianistic concept of evolution, or do we find the reverse taking place? What you have reproduced on this sheet in front of you are a series of quotes, all from non-believing, non-Christian scientists, all right? I want you to be aware of that. These are not specially, you know, sought after quotes from some Christian scientists. Everything you see here comes from, as far as we know, unless one of these people have had a conversion since they wrote what they wrote, we don't know them to be Christians. I want to begin with giving you some preliminary data before we start addressing these various topic areas. And so I don't want to frustrate you, but I'm going to just show you some things that that we found very helpful, particularly as we led into these seminars earlier in the summer. Now, before I do that, I want to tell you a little bit about Rick Oliver. He's not here, but Rick Oliver grew up in the hills of Kentucky with a mother who was an old Southern Baptist believer. And Rick and his family moved to Newport Beach when he was in junior high school. They left the hills of Kentucky and entered Newport Beach. Can some of you kind of see the little disconnect here, the paradigm shift that took? He said, we drove in with the station wagon, all the stuff heaped on it, just like the Beverly Hillbillies. And so it was a major, major time of transition for Rick. He entered high school at that point, learned the meaning of the word hick. That was what he was called. And his football coach / biology teacher, Rick was bigger than most kids, literally became his salvation. He, you know, here was someone who said you're good because he was big and he played football. But he's also the biology teacher. And he began his class by saying, if any of you in this class are Christians, I will apologize in advance because you won't be when you leave. And so what happened was, in that very impressionable stage when so much was new, Rick listened to this presentation and decided that science had the answers, religion did not. He'd never really embraced Christ in a personal way, but he said, you know, in the hills of Kentucky, everybody's a Christian. You're an American, you eat apple pie, you're a Christian. That's the way it kind of was. Never understood the personal relationship. Long and short of it is, he went through many years of his life, was a ranger in the Vietnam. God spared his life incredibly. In fact, he should have died there. Sometime I'll let him tell you that story. You'll see a scar in his throat sometime where a landmine exploded, and if it hadn't been for a Navy SEAL who appeared out of a bushes and saved his life. But God spared his life, and it was about 12 or 13 years ago that Rick finally was led, as he would say, kicking and screaming into the kingdom of heaven, the very place that he vowed he would never set foot, which was Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, is exactly where he drove his mother to church there, and he was going to drive off, and he couldn't drive the car out of the parking lot. And this, so he's sitting there holding on the steering wheel. This usher came up to him and said, hey, how'd you like to go in and join me and just sit with me? And he just was, next thing you know, he's sitting in church. I mean, he tells the story. It's one of those things where you talk about the Holy Spirit just literally capturing someone, captured Rick. And that morning, Rick walked that aisle and met Jesus Christ. Now, a more ardent believer you will hardly find today. But you have to understand that for many years of his life, he was not only an evolutionist, he was an anti-Christian. He was not content just to preach evolution, but he set out, deliberately set out, and told his mother this, I am going to disprove your God. Your God is a hoax and a fantasy. And now today, he loves to say, and the God who I tried to disprove all those years now rules my heart, and gladly so. So it's a wonderful treat to be colleagues in ministry here at Mount Hermon and to have someone. His PhD, by the way, is in evolutionary biology from UC Irvine. We had some Christian folks want to come and discuss the outdoor science curriculum here. He's the editor of the paper of a town near here, Christian. They weren't sure they wanted to let their son or daughter come to an outdoor science school. So they came to interview Rick, and he looked at him. He says, my name is Dr. Rick Oliver. My degree is in evolutionary biology from UC Irvine. And he stressed evolutionary very hard. And then he looked, and they were kind of, like this, and he said, and I love Jesus Christ intimately. And they went, oh, you know. So anyway, what you're going to see today is just a mere tip of an iceberg of research that Rick has done through the years. He speaks all over the place. He speaks to schools. He speaks in colleges. He speaks, he and Phil Johnson just did symposiums for Silicon Valley scientists and so forth. Now, I want to show you just some introductory material, and Rick and I started each of our sessions this summer by talking a little bit about our testimony, and so you know where we're coming from. First thing we need to do is define some terms. You hear the term evolution used over and over. One of the great things about scientists is if they can't quite prove something, they just change definitions or they alter definitions. Actually, that happens in many groups. But all of you today sitting here are evolutionists in one degree, and that is microevolution, which says that within species there are adaptations that take place over a period of time. That has very much been scientifically reinforced, and we know that from observation of the natural world. Now, whether you want to call that adaptation or microevolution, but that certainly makes sense and is all part of God's plan. Macroevolution is another matter altogether. Macroevolution teaches that we see change from one species to another. Birds came from reptiles or dinosaurs, etc., etc. Now, all I want to say to you, just give you a bottom line statement on this. We have absolutely no evidence in any of the branches of science for that ever happening. There is no fossil evidence. There is no evidence of any kind. I've heard Rick say this many times. So Macroevolution, which is non-empirical, that is, it cannot be tested, cannot be replicated, is a faith process. You're going to hear me say this over and over again this morning. You basically have, when it comes to the origin of life, you basically have two options from which to choose. You either have to choose on the side of intelligent design and a designer, and the anthropic principle created a universe which supports life, and you choose to believe that and orient your worldview out of that, or you choose that all that came into being came through mechanistic, naturalistic, materialistic, uniformitarianistic kind of evolution, and it had nothing to do with a supernatural God and any kind of supernatural activity of any kind. You have to, and by the way, both of those processes involve faith. It's not that one is scientific and one is faith. They are both faith processes. Why? Because there is no evidence to support macroevolution. You cannot find empirical data to support macroevolution. It's a faith process. So the question we like to ask people is, where do you want to place your faith? That's the question. Now, you'll see that borne out here. Now, when it comes to macroevolution, you have Darwinism, neo-Darwinism, uniformitarianism, punctuated equilibrium. Let me talk about punctuated equilibrium just for a moment because, and we aren't going to be real technical the whole time here, but this is a term you're going to see more and more now. Stephen Gould of Harvard has talked about this. The problem with Darwinism is it talks about a very uniform series of changes over long periods of time that move from lower forms of life to higher forms of life. Of course, we don't have any evidence for this, but that's the theory. Well, the more they find evidence, the more it doesn't match. So what they've come up with now, and Stephen Gould is particularly evocative of this position, is punctuated equilibrium, which is periods of time where not much happened, and then you have a great creative action in a certain zone in the geological strata, and then you'll have a stasis period, and then more, and then stasis. You know, it kind of reminds you of on the first day this happened, on the second day this happened, on the third day this happened. It kind of has the smacking of that, but again, they don't want to talk about it like that. And again, how do you define day? You have New Age and you have Old Age among Christians, etc. And I'm not here to discuss that whole thing because I think, again, you can have argument or you can muster evidence for both of those postures. But the issue on punctuated equilibrium is that they now don't know what it is that caused this great creative activity at a certain zone. But then they know there was a period of time where that, you know, carried on, and all of a sudden, then here's a whole new set of things that happened, and that carried on, then a whole new set of things, and so forth. So the latest theory propounded by very intelligent scientists at Harvard, Stanford, and other places is that this came from aliens. That there have been alien incursions into our universe that have started things happening, and then they've carried on, and we had another alien. Now, I only tell you this because people are grasping for answers to the issue of origins. And the data is moving away, the Hubble is providing data to, moving away from the old Darwinian evolutionary concept. So now we have to come up with new constructs. Now, if you want to place your faith in aliens coming and doing things like that, great, that's a choice you can make. On the other hand, I don't know if there's, if you just want to be scientific about this, I don't know that there's a whole lot to substantiate that more than there is to believe that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth and that he did it in a period of activities, whether it was 24-hour days or periods of time, he did it. And it now seems to be matching what's going on. The key word today, I'll just tell you, is the word intelligent design. And you are finding more and more scientists today moving under the umbrella. And these are not just Christians. These are non-Christians. Under the umbrella of intelligent design, they say, as you evaluate the universe and all that we see in it, there is a design. Sometimes it's called, some of you have read things about this, the anthropic principle. There is a design which even seems to be structured in a way to support life. It's amazing that all this just kind of happened. So they're coming to the conclusion that the odds of this happening by chance is so utterly remote that it defies logic. In fact, it defies imagination. And so they're moving into the notion that there is an intelligence to this design and that there was an intelligence involved in this design. They just don't want to talk about that intelligence yet. But they are talking about intelligent design, and you will see that. In fact, I've seen it two or three times in Time and Newsweek this summer, talking about intelligent design. So just be aware, these are some of the terms that you're going to see. Now, let me begin today with this. If you are a teacher in the state of California, this is the beginning of the teacher's manual instructing you in science. Science is a particular way of knowing about the world, and science explanations are limited to those based, now I want you to get this, to those based on observations and experiments that can be substantiated by other scientists. They are now defining how science works and the purview of science. Explanations that cannot be based on empirical evidence are not a part of science. Okay, did you get this? Now, this is how the state of California begins the science instructions for its teachers. Down here below, third paragraph. Scientists never can be sure that a given explanation is complete and final. Some of the hypotheses advanced by scientists turn out to be incorrect when tested by further observations or experiments. Great, that is what science is supposed to be, self-correcting. Yet many scientific explanations have been so thoroughly tested and confirmed that they are held with great confidence. The theory of evolution is one of these well-established explanations. Do you see the jump of logic that has just taken place when they state science up here, explanations are limited to those based on observation experiments that can be substantiated by other scientists? I just want you to catch this, because this is the kind of pervasive thinking that goes on all of the time. Here on one page, they have begun to contradict themselves. Now, let's talk about the question of what is empirical evidence, since explanations that cannot be based on empirical evidence are not a part of science. What is empirical? Here it is, out of the dictionary, empirical. This is Webster, all right? Originating in or based on observation or experience. Good. Relying on experience or observation alone, often without due regard for system or theory. Oh, that's tough. You got to throw your preconceived notions out, and you've got to base it just on what you see, okay, or what you experience. Three, capable of being verified or disproved by observation or experiment. That is what empirical means. It's based on observation and experience without regard to preconceived notions, and other people can verify or disprove what you've done. Now, I don't want you to lose sight of this as I start to show you some things today, okay? Are you with me? Here's how we define science. Based on observation experience, can be substantiated by others, that cannot be based on, are not part of science, and that's empirical. Now, here in 1976 is an excerpt from a resolution passed by the National Academy of Sciences. This, by the way, you have to work very hard to find today. Let me tell you why this was passed. This was passed because scientists were getting worried about religious people, and they didn't want religious people interfering with science. Here it is. That the search for knowledge and understanding of the physical universe and the living things that inhabit it should be conducted under conditions of intellectual freedom without religious, political, or ideological restrictions. That freedom of inquiry and dissemination of ideas require that those so engaged be free to search where their inquiry leads without political censorship and without fear of retribution in consequence of unpopularity. Something doesn't seem right there, but anyway, their conclusions. Those who challenge existing theories must be protected from retaliatory reactions. Folks, did you just hear what they said? That if we're going to do good science, it has to be free from religious, political, or ideological. You have to have free inquiry, and you don't want censorship, retribution. You must be protected from retaliatory actions. That is what the National Academy of Sciences said should happen. 1976. Can I take you to Kansas in the last 2 years with the Board of Education? Have you read about Kansas? But before I take you to Kansas, let me take you to the Wall Street Journal. in an article that appeared in August of 99. A Chinese paleontologist lectures around the world saying that recent fossil finds in his country are inconsistent with the Darwinian theory of evolution. His reason, the major animal groups appear abruptly in the rocks over a relatively short time rather than evolving gradually overcome from a common ancestor as Darwin's theory predicts. When this conclusion upsets American scientists, he wryly comments, in China we can criticize Darwin but not the government. In America you can criticize the government but not Darwin. Now, only reason, I just wanted to say, remember, this is what they said they want to do. Okay, now, I don't have a lot of time to do this, but again, this is Chuck Colson talking about the Kansas situation. The Kansas Board of Education, all they wanted to do was to introduce in the classroom of their schools teaching the theory of evolution, teaching also creationism, and saying, here are two alternative theories about the origin of life. That's all they wanted to do. Now, of course, it got distorted long beyond that. If you read the newspapers, and you probably read that the Kansas School Board removed evolution from the state's educational standards last year, which was not what they wanted to do. And the resulting controversy, voters in the state's Republican primary defeated three of the four members who supported these. Well, that's what you read, but they've been mischaracterized. Yes, three candidates were defeated, but what really happened, the Kansas School Board did not mandate teaching creationism, as critics claimed, and they did not ban the teaching of evolution. In fact, the board increased the discussion of evolution in the state guidelines. The fact is, the board never once mentioned creationism, which is often associated with the idea of young Earth and seven calendar day creation. All they did was open the door for scientific analysis of mounting and responsible evidence for intelligent design as well as natural processes. They were pitting science against science. The school board also refused to require teachers to teach Darwin's theory of evolution as scientific truth beyond dispute. The local boards were permitted to decide for themselves what to teach their children about human origins. What we have really witnessed here is a campaign of vilification from the media against this board as vicious as anything I've seen. Voters were told that the new standards would make them look like rubes and the laughingstock of the nation. They were told their kids wouldn't be able to get into college. Interestingly enough, Stanford, for example, accepts homeschoolers at twice the rate of public school kids because homeschoolers are well-grounded and they get both sides of it. What we see in this issue is proof that the secular scientists really fear is good, fair discussion of the issues. Instead of raising scientific objections, the Darwinists fomented hysteria, comparing the case to the Scopes monkey trial, and even registered Democrats to vote in the Republican primary. You see, this is an argument the secularists can't win fair and square. Not only is there mounting scientific evidence for intelligent design, but polls show that 68% of Americans support teaching both creationism and evolution, even after all the years of propaganda. Now again, we're going back here. Those who challenge existing theories must be protected from retaliatory reactions. The scientific community today is violating its own resolution. And Rick knows all about that. Now, Renzberger, non-Christian scientist. At this point, it is necessary to reveal little inside information about how scientists work, something textbooks won't tell you. The fact is, scientists are not really as objective and dispassionate in their work as they would like you to think. Most scientists first get their ideas about how the world works not through rigorously logical processes, but through hunches and wild guesses. As individuals, they often come to believe something to be true long before they assemble the hard evidence that will convince somebody else that it is. Motivated by faith in his own ideas and a desire for acceptance by his peers, a scientist will labor for years knowing in his heart that his theory is correct, but devising experiment after experiment whose results he hopes will support his position. That is how much of science works. We understand that. Now, you might say to me at this point, but the guy perceives stuff and then he writes it. How can it be wrong? Okay, I want to give you a little perception test this morning. Of all the sciences, math is the most accurate. Math just is, you know. And the sciences always attempt to use math to verify conclusions where they can. So I'm going to just test a perception thing here. I don't want you to use your pencils. I just want you to watch. I'm going to give you a series of numbers to add up. When we get to the end, I want you to tell me what the total is, okay? So here we go. We're going to test perception this morning. All right? Ready? What's the total? Okay, I got 5,000, I got 4,900, I got, what? How much? 4,090. Okay, let me tell you what the correct answer is. It's 4,100. Now, you all saw this. Oh, you didn't see the last one. I'm sorry. There's a 4090. Excuse me. Sorry about that. My fault and the projector's fault. No, it's my fault. Okay, so 4090, those of you, yeah, you can get the data. Do you know what's very interesting about this? When you run this experiment, you'll get at least half of the people swearing it's 5,000. They're convinced it's 5,000. We all saw it. You perceived it. But the question is your perception accurate? Which is why science says the way you test the theory is by replication. If others can replicate that and it is replicated over time, then the validity then goes up. Unfortunately, so much of what is put across today is not capable of replication. We take the side of science. This is Richard Lewontin. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of its tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories, because we have a prior commitment. We have a commitment to materialism. He goes on and talks about, moreover, that materialism is an absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Now, this is a non-Christian scientist being very honest here. He's just saying, we can't let this happen. So they have started with limiting your field, Now, I'm giving you all this as just kind of an intro to what we're going to talk about this morning. Another non-Christian scientist, Richard Dawkins, writing in The Blind Watchmaker, natural selection is the blind watchmaker. Blind because natural selection, of course, what Darwin said, you know, survival of the fittest. Blind because it does not see ahead, does not plan consequences, has no purpose in view. Yet the living results of natural selection overwhelmingly impress us with the appearance of design as if by a master watchmaker and impress us with the illusion of design and planning. This is what is coming home to roost for more scientists, whether it's geology, biology, zoology, astronomy, it doesn't matter today, is they are becoming overwhelmed with the incredible design. Now, another one. This is Cohen. Darwin was wrong. To propose and argue that mutations, even in tandem with natural selection, are the root causes for 6 million viable, enormously complex species is to mock logic, deny the weight of evidence, and reject the fundamentals of mathematical probability. Another non-Christian scientist. And if you have read Michael Behe's book, The Black Box, or Darwin's Black Box, as a mathematician at Lehigh University, he went through and just mathematically began to show that it is impossible for natural selection to have caused all of the changes to occur systematically in such a way that you could sustain life. I only just give you this, again, I'm not trying to argue anything here with you. All I want you to see is that whereas you may see this monolithic embracing of the scientific community, when the scientific community gets amongst themselves, here's Rick's comment. He said, as scientists, when he used to teach down there at Irvine, he said, we were always arguing amongst ourselves, but you let one creationist walk in the door, and instantly we're all buddies and we are united. Now, he said, as soon as they leave, we're all at each other's throats again because the data doesn't support it, but we have to put the united front on. That is what is happening in the scientific community, but there are people that are starting to break rank. And I think we're living in a very exciting time today. I want to just say that to you. Those of you that are in the scientific community, you have to, you know, let me know whether this is at all accurate. But I think we're living in an exciting time because people are breaking ranks. 60-some percent of the physicists in the United States of America in a poll that was just conducted, I think it was like 68%, no longer believe in the theory of evolution. Now, they can't say that publicly yet because their careers depend upon it. Their research grants are undergirded by institutions like National Geographic and Nature and some others that are just absolutely religiously committed to this. But they no longer believe. The data is overwhelmingly accumulating on the other side. The Hubble telescope is, you know, you've seen some of the images of the Hubble telescope. You've seen about 1% of the images of the Hubble telescope. There's a lot of stuff that you won't see because it doesn't support preconceived notions. Same thing is true in the area of geology. There are so many fossils that have been found that do not fit the prevailing theories. And I'll tell you what happens to them. They are sealed in canvas bags with lead seals and yellow tags put on those bags, and it's labeled anomaly. Rick has been in warehouses full of fossil evidence in sealed canvas bags with lead seals as anomalies. You'll never see these things. Why? Because they don't support the theory. What you will see are those that they can find that somehow support the theory. But the evidence is mounting. There are sites that Rick has been on. He spent time on a dinosaur dig last summer. There are numerous sites that are bulldozed over with cyclone fences and razor wire put across the top so no one can get back into these places because what they have found doesn't support the evidence. They find human footprints with dinosaur footprints walking side by side. See, you can't explain that unless you can talk about creation. Then you can explain that. So all of this is to say that the evidence is growing stronger all of the time. And again, as a Christian, you don't have to park your brains outside the church to believe that our worldview, which we accept by faith, we weren't there when God created the heavens and the earth. We accept this by faith. But guess what? The evolutionists are doing the same thing. Theirs is a faith process. And they have no more. In fact, let me say this. They're having, as time goes on, there is less and less stuff coming to support their notion than even the creation notion. But it's a faith decision on either side of the coin. Now, let's just talk about the worksheet here. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Many people believe that science and fossil record proves evolution, therefore proving there is no creator. In this lesson, we'll examine what evolutionary scientists have to say about science and the fossil record. Let's see what they say about the origin of life. This is Charles Thaxton and Paul Taylor from this book. Furthermore, no geological evidence indicates an organic soup ever existed on this planet. We may therefore, with fairness, call this scenario the myth of the prebiotic soup. Another quote, this one from Michael Denton, Evolution, a Theory and Crisis. Considering the way the prebiotic soup is referred to in so many discussions of the origin of life as an already established reality, it comes as something of a shock to realize there is absolutely no positive evidence for its existence. Now, what is the prebiotic soup? All right. The prebiotic soup idea came when Stanley Miller, back in the 50s, along with his laboratory assistant, Harold Urey, tried to think of a way to explain the origin of amino acids on planet Earth. Now, by the way, can I just say to you, I'm going to show you this thing, and I'm going to tell you that my daughter, who just graduated with a degree in neurobiology, physiology, and behavior from UC Davis, in her textbook, published in 1998, is this same experiment, which has been thoroughly discredited by the scientific community. Not only that, in the September 2000 Scientific American, it was the Scientific American, it was writers in Scientific American who discredited this thing back in the 60s and the 70s, but guess what? In the September 2000 Scientific American, on the cover, revolutions in science, and guess what one of the things they have pictured as a revolution in science is this, Stanley Miller's experiment, which has been discredited. I'm just going to show you a little bit about this so you can be alert to this because people will hold this up as the way it started. Now, what was the notion here? The notion is, how can we explain the beginning of life on this planet? So the notion is that there was a soup, a liquid that covered this Earth. And as volcanoes began to erupt, it began to heat this thing. And there was an atmosphere with methane and nitrogen and other chemicals and lightning, you know. And as the electric sparks combined with these the water vapor and these other chemicals, that what happened out of this was condensed amino acids. They formed chemically in this time. And that these amino acids then somehow mysteriously began joining to one another. And then they mysteriously began combining with other amino acids until mysteriously life happened. Okay, that's the thought. That is the notion of prebiotic. Okay, I could read this through here. Anyway, what you have is a flask that they heated. This is the experiment, and water vapor came up, and then here in this circle of glass, they have electrodes which are recreating lightning. And what you have now is water vapor, and they have injected into this, in this little ball up here, they've already got ammonia, nitrogen, and hydrogen in gaseous form. And they tried this over and over, and they finally got this to work. And what happened was they found some amino acids were formed. Here are some of the amino acids. They show you how it took place. And it came down here. They put a condenser on here to cool it, saying that as it fell through the air, it would cool. And then it came down, and the idea was that it would fall back into this soup, and now they could draw from the soup these amino acids and say, aha, now we're started. We're beginning to figure this out. The problem was that all the amino acids, once they got back to the heated liquid, died. They dissolved. They couldn't stay in their form in the hot liquid. So they then revised the experiment to this, which is what Sarah had in her textbook, was they then decided we'll put a little pipette here and we'll draw it off before it gets back to this and dissolves again. Well, that's pretty creative, because if the Earth was covered with a prebiotic soup that was hot, and this was all happening in the atmosphere, and it all fell back into the soup, where there was a little spigot to draw this stuff off, who knows, but maybe there was one somewhere. But it's a faith process, folks. That's all I want you to see. It takes a lot of faith to subscribe to this. All right, now, that is all. That's the so-called Stanley Miller experiment. Now, all that explains is that there were, and by the way, they have never been able to replicate this. That is why this is discredited today. Remember what empirical says, based on observation, capable of being substantiated. They can't get it to work again. It worked one time out of 50-some times, and now they can't get it to work again. Even the Scientific American, this came out of the 2000 September issue. You read all about it, and they talk about it, the experiment, yielded many aminos, and explains how, and for instance, glycine, and you know, after the experiment, a meteorite struck Australia, and they found the same amino acids, and then they got one sentence down here. More recent findings have cast some doubt on this conclusion. That's the only thing they're going to say. Well, let me talk to you about the doubt that is cast on this conclusion. Let me just let some scientists talk to you about it. Here's a non-Christian scientist, Noam, can't pronounce his last name, but under Bioenergies. Under slightly reducing conditions, the Miller-Urey action does not produce amino acids, nor does it produce the chemicals that may serve as the predecessors of other important biopolymers building blocks. Thus, by challenging the assumption of a reducing atmosphere, we challenge the very existence of the prebiotic soup with its richness of biologically important organic compounds. Moreover, so far, no geochemical evidence for the existence of a prebiotic soup concept, there isn't any, noting concentration of organic building blocks in it would have been far too small for any prebiotic evolution. Okay, I know it's a little complicated, but basically you get the gist of it. He's saying it wouldn't work. All right, here's another one. Prebiotic soup. This comes from, I can't pronounce these guys' names. I don't know why we don't have science. They're great people. I just can't pronounce their names. Anyway, however, it is now held to be highly unlikely that the conditions used in these experiments, that's the Miller-Urey experiment, the modeling of a strongly reducing atmosphere, could represent those in the old or archaean atmosphere. Even so, scientific articles still occasionally appear that report experiments modeled on these conditions and explicitly or tacitly claim the presence of resulting products in reactive concentrations on the primordial Earth or in a prebiotic soup. The idea of such a soup containing all the desired organic molecules in concentrated form in the ocean has been a misleading concept against which objections were raised early. Here's 165. Nonetheless, it still appears in popular presentations, perhaps because of its gustatory associations. I don't even know what a gustatory association is, but it sounds good. Therefore, we keep talking about it, yet it's a discredited experiment. My daughter came home and said, Dad, do you know that it's possible to create these amino acids? I said, really? Let's go talk to Rick. After she talked to Rick, she said, why aren't these scientists talking about the fact that they can't reproduce this thing and that they now know that this wasn't present? Why aren't they talking about it? And the answer is, they don't have anything to substitute for it. We can't let go of it. It is the only thing, even though it's been discredited, it's the only thing. Now, but let's go one step further. Let's say that in the prebiotic soup, amino acids did happen. How did they go from being amino acids floating around to a cell? How did they come from inert molecules to life? So Rick loves to do this. I've heard him say this many times. He said, with evolution, he said, I'll tell you what. I'll give you all those amino acids, but I'll go far better. Let's take a living cell, let's kill it, and put it in there. Now you've got everything you need. You've got it all. You've got the amino acids, you got all the cell. Make it come to life. Can't do it. You got all the components, but you can't bring life into it. Why? How did life happen? God spoke and God breathed. Or aliens came. I don't know, whatever. Something like this happened, but we can't explain it. Now, again, I want you to get this notion. It's a faith process. It's not that one is rational and the other irrational. They are both faith processes. You have to make a determination on worldview. Another quote, Fred Hoyle, who is not a Christian. At all events, anyone with even a nodding acquaintance with a Rubik's Cube will concede the near impossibility of a solution being obtained by a blind person moving the cubic faces at random. Okay, you know what a Rubik's Cube is? Okay. Now imagine 10 to the 50 blind people, each with a scrambled Rubik's Cube, and try to conceive of the chance that all of them simultaneously, blindly, will arrive at the solved form at the same time. You then have the chance of arriving by random shuffling at just one of the many biopolymers on which life depends. It's just one. The notion that not only biopolymers, but the operating program of a living cell could be arrived at by chance in a primordial organic soup here on Earth is evidently nonsense of a high order. This is a non-Christian writing about this experiment. Now again, this is just, these are, you know, people talking about this process. Here we go, another one. The complexity of the simplest known type of cell is so great that it is impossible to accept that such an object could have been thrown together by some kind of freakish, vastly improbable event. Such an occurrence would be indistinguishable from a miracle. 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 That's a scientist using a term like miracle. But again, these are credible people trying to make sense out of what we see. I've said for years, Ernest Chain, I've said for years that speculations about the origin of life lead to no useful purpose, as even the simplest living system is far too complex to be understood in terms of the extremely primitive chemistry scientists have used in their attempts to explain the unexplainable that happened billions of years ago. God cannot be explained away by such naive thoughts. It's a scientist. He said God, in a nice way. Okay, anyway, you're getting the point. Here are cells, all right? I didn't really talk to you about the origin of cell, but if you go back and you look at your worksheet, how life originated and how the first cell came into being are matters of speculation, since these events cannot be reproduced in the laboratory, from Harvard Medical School. Now watch this. However, the macromolecule to cell transition is a jump of fantastic dimensions. That's the jump from amino acids to combinations of amino acids to cell. Okay, the macromolecule to cell transition is a jump of fantastic, which lies beyond the range of testable hypothesis. Do you remember the definition of science? Science had to be testable. So what this scientist is saying is you can't. In this area, all is conjecture. The available facts do not provide a basis for postulating that cells arose on this planet. This is not to say that some, now we can't use the word God, but we're going to talk about paraphysical. Paraphysical forces were at work. We simply wish to point out that there is no scientific evidence. The physicist has learned to avoid trying to specify when time began and when matter was created, except within the framework of frank speculation. The origin of the precursor cell appears to fall into the same category of unknowables. David Green, University of Wisconsin, Goldberger, National Institutes of Health. Again, you know, what do cells look like? They're supposed to be simple. There's a simple plant cell. Here's a simple animal cell. But folks, that's not simple. And to go from a group of amino acids to this is a jump. And it's a fantastic jump. And yet that is the jump that one has to believe if one subscribes to the worldview that evolution explains. It's a faith process. Have you heard me say this before yet? It takes great faith to be an evolutionist. Great faith. In fact, I've actually said that to some of my evolutionist friends. I've said, you know, I admire your faith. You are a man of faith. They don't always like that term, but folks, it's true. They are great men of faith, which is why they ought to be so susceptible for the gospel. You know, I mean, literally. Now, what I have done is managed to throw the worksheets back here, along with everything else. Let me see if I can find, there it is, got it, okay. Let's go down and talk about plants. We're not going to get through all this today, but we'll get through some of it. Origin of plants. As of yet, we've not been able to trace the phylogenetic history of a single group of modern plants from its beginning to the present. So again, the notion, you know how you see these trees with things branching off and higher forms coming from lower forms. Problem is, I can't find it. Okay? Now, here's a very interesting article. Evolutionary theory emphasizes the survival of the fittest. You ever heard that before? Evolutionists generally hold that instances of cooperation and even altruism seen in nature are only the principle of the wolf pack, that is, organisms banding together temporarily for mutual benefit in the struggle for survival. Dawkins, in his book, The Selfish Gene, paints a picture of the living world as a selfish dog-eat-dog place where the self-seeking behavior of many competing gene pools is the only reality. Now, let me ask you a question. If evolution is indeed the survival of the fittest, the weak die off, the strong are the ones that are preserved, and they pass on their genetic structures, and it gets stronger and stronger, what would happen if you could find a whole species, maybe a whole phyla, that doesn't operate that way? What would that say about the viability of this theory? Well, guess what? It's been found. Such a view of the living world presents a major paradox. What if there were a fundamental division of the living world in which those organisms possessed of a superior biochemical mechanism for sustaining themselves did not dominate their biochemical inferiors? Suppose these biochemically superior organisms sacrifice themselves in endless, unselfish service to organisms with an inferior cellular makeup. What would that say about the whole theory of natural selection? Would it not at least cause you to think that perhaps this isn't as ironclad as, you know, like they said in that science thing at the beginning, like the theory of evolution? Well, can I tell you what that division is? It's plants. Plants are biologically superior to animals because they don't need food from the outside. They make their own. They have all that they need from the natural world. They've got moisture, they've got sunlight, they have all the cellular makeup to sustain themselves with food. And yet, what do plants do? They continuously sacrifice themselves to sustain animals and man. Is that not interesting? That you have a huge division of the created world which does not fit the theory of natural selection. Just point that out. That's all I want to do. What are we giving you? Just little seeds of data to challenge thought. All right? Let me go on to the next one here. I'm going to skip, but let's talk about fishes and birds, and then we got to get to the fossil record and dating. But origin of fishes. The geological record has so far provided no evidence as to the origin of fishes. We have no idea how fish came into being. They just appeared. It's almost as if someone spoke and they happened. Let's talk about birds. The evolutionary origin of birds is largely a matter of deduction. There is no fossil evidence of the stages through which the remarkable change from reptile to bird was achieved. Now, this gets a little tender at this point, so let me just deal with these a little tenderly. First of all, marine life. If any event in life's history resembles man's creation myths, it is this sudden diversification of marine life when multicellular organisms took over as the dominant actors in ecology and evolution. Baffling and embarrassing to Darwin, this event still dazzles us and stands as a major biological revolution on a par with the invention of self-replication and the origin of the eukaryotic or the original cell. The animal phyla emerged out of the Precambrian myths with most of the attributes of their modern descendants. In other words, it all of a sudden happened and they all had what they needed to have at that point in time and it didn't go through a whole series of stages. Another, Nature magazine is not exactly a creationist journal, folks. It's a very evolutionary journal, and yet here writing in it, you get this kind of stuff. Now, let's talk about birds here for a minute, because do you remember this? I don't have this in color, but do you remember down at the bottom, Dinosaurs Take Wings, The Origin of Birds, National Geographic, July 1998. Do some of you remember this? Any of you remember this? Do any of you take National Geographic? All right. I used to. This is not, you don't have to adopt this, but I became so discouraged with their message. I mean, it is so evangelistic for evolution that it defies thinking. So when I said to Rachel, I love the pictures, but I can't handle the text. So we don't take it anymore. But that's not to say, if you that take it, it's good because you can stay abreast of what that thinking is. So Well, anyway, they had this big thing about, this is a, if I had this in color, you could see it, but this was a dinosaur-looking thing with feathers. And all of this, in fact, it comes with really neat diagrams inside, you know, and it talks about how we go from dinosaurs to bigger dinosaurs, to dinosaurs whose front limbs started changing, and the next thing you know, they started sprouting feathers, and then they started learning how to fly and flap, and now we got birds. See, here it is. This is really neat. In fact, here's how their theropod dinosaur arm changed to become a wing. It's wonderful stuff. It's all fantasy. There isn't a single fossil to document any of this stuff. But it looks good. It's kind of like the, you know, Origin of Man. You've seen the pictures of the hunched over thing that suddenly straightens up, and we don't have that either. But we grew up with that in our textbooks. That this is the way it happened. Folks, it's an artist's imagination. Now, let me just talk to you about this one, because we actually had some folks here that I remember 2 years ago that were very upset with Rick Oliver, because he said, I'm not here to argue with you. I'm just here to tell you that as a scientist, I can't believe that could happen. And here's why. My specialty is herpetology. That's snakes. That's what Rick's PhD was done, venomous snakes and so forth. He has about, I shouldn't tell you this, you'll never come back. He has several of them in his house, which he uses for teaching purposes. Anyway, but we keep them under lock and key. They've only been out, just in Lakeside. They've never been anywhere else. No, I'm just kidding. Okay, anyway, what Rick would tell you is that when you look at the skin of a snake, the scales, supposedly the feathers came out of scales. Scales are folded skin. Feathers are follicular. That is, they come out of a follicle. Your hair comes out of a follicle. Follicle? How do you say the word? Follicle. Cool. Cool. Anyway, follicle. Under a microscope, if you look at the follicle cell for a hair and the follicle cell for a feather, you have to be a very trained scientist to see any difference in that cell, which produces either a hair or a feather. So feathers are follicular. Reptiles have no follicles. They have folded skin, which becomes scales. So even the, quote, origin of feathers doesn't even make sense in the way they describe the scales slowly moving into feather-like shape. It doesn't fit. But let's just say that it did. Now, do you know how they explain reptiles becoming birds? You'll notice that it gets bigger, but then it has to get smaller. And what they hypothesize is that these small dinosaurs, which were like lizards, fed off insects. I'm going to tell you, this is the theory, fed off insects. And as they were going around getting insects, they were hunting insects in places where there were cliffs and there were, you know, changes in elevation. And the ones that could leap out into the sky to catch these insects and make it safely to the bottom survived, where those that couldn't make it safe to the bottom went splat and died. So the theory was that the lizards that had little extra flaps of skin under their front arms learned how to glide like flying squirrels. And that over time, these gliding lizards sprouted more skin, and somehow the skin went from scales to follicles, and follicles sprouted feathers, and the feathers, they started to learn how to use these, and they developed, and so here's what you got, see? Now, there's no faith in this process. Come on, folks. Faith? Is there faith in this process? Now, let's just talk about faith. Of course, in the process of this happening, the bones had to change shape and all become hollow, too, you know, so that they were light enough to sustain flight. Just little details here, but, you know, this is how it all happened. So now let me ask you this question. Let's say this is happening. So now we've got lizards running around with sort of crippled front legs, all right, with feathers hanging off of them in some fashion. How effective are these lizards going to be at running away from predators and at capturing food? How effective are they going to be while they're in this transitory stage? You think they'd be pretty good at this, or would they be slightly impeded by this process? Here's my favorite line. Rick says, do you know what we call one of those lizards that's sort of in this Sage? Lunch. They're going to be lunch for some predator because they can't work either side of the coin. They can't run away. They can't fly away yet. There's sort of in this. Now, I just say this to you because, again, you have to make a decision. Your friends have to make a decision based on faith, not fact. Okay? There are some facts, but the facts supporting the mechanistic, naturalistic, materialistic, uniformitarianistic concept of evolution as the origin of life and the origin of species are lessening. The more we look at this stuff, the less there is to support that. So your faith has to grow now in the light of less evidence, which is kind of what's happening. Now, just don't take my word for it on a bird thing here. Let me let you go to the National Museum of Natural History, Smithsonian Institute, that wonderful Christian institution there in Washington, D.C. I'm just kidding. I don't know they're anti-Christian, but they're certainly not a Christian institution. Here's what the head of the curator bird says. The idea of feathered dinosaurs and the theropod origin of birds is being actively promulgated by a cadre of zealous scientists acting in concert with certain editors of Nature magazine and National Geographic who have become outspoken and highly biased proselytizers of faith. Truth and careful scientific weighing of evidence have been among the first casualties in their program, which is now fast becoming one of the grander scientific hoaxes of our age, the paleontological equivalent of cold fusion. If Sloan's article is not the crescendo of this fantasia, it is difficult to imagine to what heights it can be next taken. But it is certain that when the folly has run its course and has been fully exposed, National Geographic will unfortunately play a prominent but unenviable role in the book that summarizes this whole sorry episode. Now, here was where it all got started. A bird fossil is hailed as a major find until a red-faced scientist discovered it was doctored. They had a doctored fossil. They combined stuff together to make a fossil. And this all got reported. You know, it started in China. That's where it all started. Made for good press. But folks, it's totally fallacious. But now, may I say to you, do you know how hard this dies? I don't know if I brought these. Yeah, look at it. Here's how hard it dies. This is Tuesday, August 22nd, 2000. What was that, a week ago? Study bolsters bird-dinosaur link. Close look at bones indicates speed, organization, not lethargic plodding. And you can read this article. The problem is the data doesn't support it. But our preconceived notion says this has to be right. So therefore, we write lots of articles. Stephen Gould. Stephen Gould is one of the most formative thinkers in this area from Harvard. But how do you get from nothing such an elaborate something if evolution must proceed through a long sequence of intermediate stages, each favored by natural selection? You can't fly with 2% of a wing or gain much protection from an iota similarity with a potentially concealing piece of vegetation. How, in other words, can natural selection explain the incipient stages of structures that can only be used as we now observe them in much more elaborate forms? He's raising a great question. How can this be? It actually can't be. But, folks, it dies hard. Here it is, the ultimate science calendar. Friday, August 11th. Fossil discoveries and the anatomical evidence now overwhelmingly confirm that birds descended from small two-legged meat-eating dinosaurs. It does? Folks, it doesn't. But they're saying it does. And if we say it enough times, then it does, right? Okay, I'm getting a little worked up. I'm sorry. I don't want to get worked up here. Birds can, in fact, be classified as dinosaurs, specifically as members of the theropod lineage. Feathers and other definitely avian features seem to have appeared first as hunting adaptations in speedy, ground-based, going after those bugs, lizards. Only later were they co-opted and refined for flight by a group recognized as birds. This is just this month. You find this stuff over and over. Now, let me show you something else that's really interesting. Name for me your favorite dinosaurs. Tyrannosaurus Rex, that came from a guy. Gotta be a guy. Guys like Tyrannosaurus. Was that a guy? Oh, Robbie. Little aggressive, Robbie, for a girl. It's usually guys like Tyrannosaurus Rex. Okay, what's another big dinosaur? Brontosaurus? Did somebody say Brontosaurus? That's what I was only hearing. Do you know that it never existed? Well, at least it didn't exist as you've seen it exist. Now, for instance, here's a rather scientific journal. Actually, it's a placemat. But see, you know, There's how many of you have seen pictures of Brontosaurus? Okay. There is no such thing. The wrong-headed dinosaur. Even the great brontosaurus has changed. This is the dinosaur most people know best. Millions have seen it in books and advertising. Unfortunately, the brontosaurus never existed, even though it was pictured in every dinosaur book and museum for 100 years. The dinosaur was discovered with the head missing. So, to make the skeleton complete, a scientist added a skull found 3 or 4 miles away. So they plunked that skull on the rest of the thing, and you created a dinosaur called a brontosaurus. So this is what the old thing looks like. The new thing has a very different kind of head. It doesn't look as friendly as the old nice brontosaurus used to. Sorry, I hope this doesn't destroy your sleep tonight or something. But now again, all I'm saying to you is science should correct itself. That's kind of what it said, right? Self-correcting. All right, now, I got to hustle here. Let me just finish here with dating. There's so much more we could talk about. Let's talk about how do you date stuff. What process do we use to date things? Carbon-14. That's what everybody always says. Carbon-14. Carbon-14. How far back can you go with carbon-14?
50,000 years.
You're right. Who said that? Yeah, good for you. And that's a stretch. 60,000 is a stretch. It's pretty accurate to about 10,000 years. Beyond 10,000, its accuracy starts falling off with high orders of magnitude. When you get to 40, 50, maybe 60,000, it's highly inaccurate, but it's the best thing we've got to that stage. Now, good point. Okay, so we use carbon-14. Now, have you ever heard dates like 3.7 million years old, 2.4 million years old? You heard those things? Okay. How do we date that? Yes, it is. That is correct. We use radioactive isotopes to do that. And radioactive isotopes, like here it is, here's uranium-238, which goes to lead, which assumes a uniform rate of decay. That, by the way, is now coming under question, that all these things that uniformly, we now aren't sure that they're uniform. Even the speed of light has now come into question. Speed of light has now been shown to go slower at certain times and faster at certain times than the 186,000 miles per second. So that's coming out, which, by the way, if that thing gets challenged, the whole theory of relativity goes out the window, and all the ages of the stars out there so far away, now all of that's going to have to get recalibrated. Very interesting. That's just happening as we speak. This summer, some of those experiments are coming out. But let's talk about dating. The dating process, which was one of the things when I was growing up, used to bother me. How can this be true? If God created all this stuff, well, could God create with age? Sure, God could create with age. But how did God create? I don't really know how God created, other than I know that he did it in specific periods of time. He spoke and it happened, and I believe that's how it happened. Now, some of you may say it's 24-hour days, and I would not quibble with you because I can't quibble with you. On the other hand, some of you would say that the Hebrew there talks about a period versus an exact 24-hour day, and that is also true, depending on which way you parse the Hebrew. So, but in any case, God created. Now, the dating thing. Can I tell you a little bit how dating works? I've heard Rick talk about this many times. Rick was at Mount St. Helens. If Mount St. Helens had erupted 1.5 hours later, Rick Oliver would have been killed. He was to have been the observer on the ridge where the man who took the pictures and then was, killed, I can't remember his name, that was his post. He was up there observing that. So 1.5 hours later, Rick would have died. That was something that started Rick thinking about God. He was not a Christian at this point. Over the years, Rick was with the first 4 scientists that went into the dome at Mount St. Helens. Over a period of 12 years after that initial explosion, in the center of the crater of Mount St. Helens, a volcanic plume has grown up. It's now about 1,000 feet high. It's composed of dacite. That's the rock. He and his fellow scientists chipped a small piece of dacite. This dacite is 12 years old. That is, it bubbled in molten form, hardened. They watched it harden. It's now 12 years old, and they sent it to 7 different dating laboratories, the same rock. The youngest date given to this dacite was 370,000 years old. The oldest date was 3.7 million years old. Now, how do you date dacite? Radioactive isotopes. And he can talk to you about the rings and all this kind of stuff. I can't talk to you about that. He has these fancy words. But all I can say to you is that it is a very imprecise science when it comes to dating. Is that borne out by the fact that the same rock went from, it's actually 12 years old in terms of having hardened, but it went from 370 to 3.7 million years old, the same rock. Carbon-14 cannot be used to date fossils. Why? Because fossils are not organic material. Carbon-14 only works on carbon-based life forms. Rock is not carbon-based. So what you have to find is an igneous rock somewhere near where the sedimentary rocks, because fossils are found in sedimentary rocks, you have to find an igneous rock in the strata or near the strata, and you can then date through radioactive isotopes the igneous rock. But you're beginning to see that there's some stretches involved here with dating, the dating process. Now I'm going to give you one last little secret. Rick said that when we found certain fossils and we wanted them to fit a certain geological time period, we knew which laboratory to send it to. If you want young dating, 370,000 to a million, you always send it to these laboratories. He said, invariably, whatever fossil you send to certain laboratories is going to come back, and he said, I can tell you the range, 2.4 to 2.9 million years old. They'll all come back in that same range. These laboratories over here date 3.5 to 4.2 million years old. You just knew where you needed that fossil to fit, and you sent it to that laboratory, and then you could stand up and say, based on such and such a laboratory, this thing is dated such and such a date. Why? It's terribly imprecise, the dating process. Again, just want you to know that. I didn't put up all these little thingies here, but you can take now. Now, here's something that's very interesting. How do you handle one tree being in multiple layers of strata? Okay, that's another problem they have. But Mount St. Helens corrected a lot of that because, do you know how long it takes to petrify a tree? 1 hour. You can take a tree and turn it into petrified wood in 1 hour. All you need is enough pressure, proper mineral content, and heat. And that is what happened at Mount St. Helens. Mount St. Helens so challenged many of the theories. They had canyons carved in minutes. They had 600 feet of strata laid down, on and on and on. I'm going to close with the fossil record today because if you'll notice the quote from Darwin, did you see the quote in your worksheet, which I've dispensed with somewhere here, from Darwin? What's that quote say? Darwin says, the fossil record really helps my theory, right? What does he say? Folks, you're a little mute here. The fossil record is probably the gravest and most obvious of the many objections which may be urged against my views. You know why? They don't have fossil records of the so-called intermediary species and the tracking up. So, you know, here's another quote. The known fossil record is not, never has been, in accord with gradualism. What is remarkable is that through a variety of historical circumstances, even the history of opposition has been obscured. The majority of paleontologists felt their evidence simply contradicted Darwin's stress on minute, slow, and cumulative changes leading to species transformation. And guess what? Their story has been suppressed. Well, I could go on. I could talk to you about Lucy. By the way, I just tell you a little bit about Lucy. The Australopithecine something or other, you know, the supposed origin of all. The interesting about Lucy is they found half her skeleton in one zone, but they needed her to walk upright. So guess where they found the knee joints? 3 miles away in strata, 200 feet different from where they found her skeleton. They merged these two things and created Lucy, so that they now have Lucy as an upright walker. Although latest evidence now is showing that she was not, because of the metatarsal, metacarpal, what is it? Carpal here and tarsal there, right? Carpal situations. I just want to just say this to you, that when you see these things, remember that you have a group of people that have committed themselves by faith to a worldview. And that worldview is that evolution has to explain it. Because if it isn't evolution, it's this other side. And this other side involves something supernatural. So it's not like there's a whole lot of options in between. It's this or this. And folks, you have to make a decision, and I think most of you have, as to what you're going to choose to believe. But it is a faith process, no matter which side you place your trust in. Question back there. Is this a question for everybody, or you want to tackle me afterwards? It's just, again, what's neat, what you just heard there is what's happening. We are living in a very exciting era where more and more the scientific evidence is lending credence to the biblical record. That's the exciting thing. And so you look at that last quote, I'll leave you with BC here, something very scholarly. What does metamorphosis mean? You're asking a slug? Okay, then you get this. All things were made by him, and without him nothing was made that was made. Gibberish, foolishness. Who the heck is him? Well, that would be God. Ha 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 ha. What's so funny? You've totally lost touch with reality. This guy's a nutcase. Okay, you tell me, where did everything come from? It all made itself up. It was all here to begin with. UFOs trucked it in. So anyway, you see, you get the point here. It's a faith process. And that's the gist of it. And there is nothing, that last quote comes from a non-Christian scientist on your worksheet, that there is nothing in science today that controverts the notion of God. In fact, the more evidence we're getting, the more plausible that explanation is becoming, because all the other explanations fall short. So does science disprove a creator? Nope, sure doesn't. And in fact, science is actually bolstering that notion as time goes on here. Tomorrow, we're going to tackle a subject that I'm a little better versed in than the science thing today. Did I do okay? I was really nervous about today. I've listened to Rick do this 8 times this summer, so I'm getting closer to being able to speak with a little bit of the terminologies. But tomorrow, we're going to take a look at the notion of Jesus' uniqueness, his divinity, and is he indeed the only way? Because in America today, that's not a popular notion. You know, America welcomes all. There ought to be more than one way to God. So we're going to look at this. How do you counter the person? How do you, with respect and gentleness, deal with a person who says, gosh, I think there ought to be more than one way? So tomorrow we're going to talk about that, again, from a very logical perspective. I just pose this question to you. If you believe that God used the evolutionary process, if man was indeed created in the image of God and man evolved from lower life forms, then were those lower life forms also in the image of God? I mean, that's an interesting question as a Christian. So these are just logical questions that you can ask about this process. Well, it's been great having you here, folks. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great Sunday. God's given us a beautiful day. Thank you.